own feet. Internel appears to be in a pretty good position to do that, to get to sustainable levels even without government stimulus.
Walt Maloney at the National Association of Realtors. First GM and now Chrysler reporting double-digit sales jumps in May compared to a year ago. Chrysler saying it's the first month they've sold more than 100,000 vehicles in more than 2 years. Rally on Wall Street, the Dow up 130 points. I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this Worldview Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. We're going to be talking today about the Gulf oil spill that has taken place. I'm sure everybody in our listening audience is aware of that. We'll give a little bit of a update on exactly what happened and what happened when here in just a few moments with our special guest. But we just heard word here just this morning that the latest effort in the Gulf there to be able to cap that open oil well that is spewing so much oil into the Gulf, the latest effort was to lower a remote-controlled saw to cut off the pipe that is coming out of the ground and then cap that pipe. Well, that the saw now is stuck. And so that's the latest update on the situation there in the Gulf. The saw went down, was in the middle of cutting that, and somehow something happened with the saw, and the saw is stuck. And so the oil is still spewing out of that pipe and, of course, causing all sorts of havoc there in the Gulf. And so we wanted to talk about this issue from a Christian perspective. We want to talk about all of the aspects of what are taking place. There are numerous aspects on this entire disaster that has taken place. For instance, one would be just environmentally and then economically and politically. So all of these different areas that need to be scrutinized, that we need to look at and analyze and say from a Christian perspective, how should we be dealing or speaking about, or what should we be calling for as evangelical Christians? And so today on the broadcast, I wanted to talk about evangelicals and ecological or ecological crisis. You know, when these things take place, how do we respond to these various issues? To help me do that today, we have Jamie Dean. Jamie is the news editor for World Magazine, but she also has the cover story on this week's World Magazine. It's actually the June 5th edition, but it's out already. It's already been delivered to my mailbox. It can be delivered to your mailbox, too. I'll give you details on that shortly. But the cover story written by Jamie is called Gulf Toil: How Perhaps the World's Worst Oil Spill Affects Jobs, Energy, Food, and Wildlife. And so this is a very, very interesting story, and certainly something that we as believers and citizens of this country should be interested in. With that, let me go ahead and welcome Jamie onto the program today. I mentioned that Jamie Dean is the news editor of World Magazine. And Jamie, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jamie, you've written a very interesting piece here, maybe put a little bit more of a personal face on some of the disruption of business, the disaster that is taking place there in the Gulf, especially right off of Louisiana, I believe, is where you were at. But tell us a little bit, give us a little bit of a summary of this piece that you wrote for World Magazine and what our listeners would find when they read through this.
Well, I did spend a few days down in the Gulf Coast just talking to people and seeing how this oil spill affected them. Of course, the trouble in the Gulf started on April 20th when a well, basically everything that was supposed to plug up the well didn't work, and so all of these natural gases came flying up through the well, caused an explosion on the Deepwater Horizon rig that we know killed 11 people, and then began spewing really untold amounts of oil into the Gulf of Mexico every day, at least 500,000 gallons of oil, they're now saying, a day. That's a higher estimate than what they said initially. So, of course, we wanted to find out how is that affecting people, especially down on the Gulf Coast. And I was especially interested in this story because I spent a lot of time in the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina almost 5 years ago and met a lot of the folks down there and then watched them struggle to rebuild, try to get back all the things that they had lost, which in many of these, especially small coastal communities, was everything. And so I was eager to get back there and see how those folks were doing. And, of course, they're devastated by this, and many of those communities depend on the seafood industry. Many of these guys are third and fourth generation fishermen in this area, and they are just now really getting back on their feet from Hurricane Katrina and are facing a new disaster that could really threaten to wipe them out once again.
So the disaster from an environmental standpoint is obviously extremely large. As I think you termed it in your the cover story here, perhaps the world's worst oil spill. Apparently, the last few days they've been actually saying that it is the worst oil-related disaster that we have had. I don't know if that's in the world, certainly in this country. The impact of that on the environment really has not been told, right? I mean, a lot of the oil is beneath the surface. You entitled I think the inside of this article, when you turn to it in the page, says what lies beneath. You can see it in the water. So a lot of this is settled beneath the surface, and so we're not quite sure of exactly what sort of environmental damage this is going to do. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. That's the question that everyone wants to know the answer to. And, you know, even exactly what is going on beneath the water is a bit of a question. You know, a lot of scientists are saying that there are these plumes of oil underneath the water that could, you know, travel to other areas and cause damage, could suck oxygen out of the water, which would, of course, affect whatever wildlife is in the water. And so that alone could wreak a lot of havoc. And then some people are concerned about the chemicals that BP is dumping into that water to try to break up the oil. Of course, they want to try to disperse as much of the oil as possible so that it doesn't glob together. And so they're dumping these chemicals into the water, chemicals that are relatively toxic. I mean, pretty high levels of toxin in these chemicals. And so some people, especially, again, fishermen, are worried about what that could mean for the wildlife there in the water. So a lot of these questions are unanswered at this point. I mean, we know that officials are concerned about this because they're closing large swaths of water to fishing. And so we know that they're concerned about it and just waiting to see what all of this means.
Yeah, that chemical dispersant that you were talking about, I understand that it has never been used at this level before. It has, I guess it's effective actually for breaking up the oil. We are seeing some stories about the oil coming ashore, but coming ashore kind of bound to sand and other things in the ocean. So it kind of causes it to coagulate a little bit and bring it together. I guess that'll make the pickup of it a little bit easier, as well as, you know, just dispersing it, spreading it out thinner as well, so that it just isn't so heavy in certain areas. But as you mentioned, this dispersant has never been used at this type of levels. They did stop using it for a short period of time. They were then given the green light to go ahead and start using it again, especially when they felt that, like, cutting this pipe, there was going to be at least 20% more levels of oil going into the Gulf, and they felt that it was better to use the chemical rather than not use it. So we've got this tremendous environmental impact that this is going to have. Let's switch just a little bit. You mentioned it slightly, but the economic part of this, obviously, fishing is done there right now. We probably could say fishing is going to be over in that area for the rest of the summer. Do you feel that's a fair assessment?
Well, there is still some fishing going on there. There are some waters that are still open, especially recreational fishing. Those guys are able to still find pockets of water that are open, and they can go out there and fish. And some commercial fishermen can fish as well. So there will be some fishing going on. It will be very, very limited, and especially for people who depend on these waters that are closed. I mean, you know, I was talking with fishermen on the Gulf Coast, and they were saying, you know, all of the areas where we fish are closed right now, and we can't just move on to the next area. You know, they were making the point that not all of these waters are equally productive for fishing, so it's not like they can just take their boats and go somewhere else and get the same kind of catch. So it's a little bit more complicated than saying, well, there's all this water that's still open, why don't you just go there? No, you know, what a lot of these guys are saying is that we're shut down. I mean, these are guys who know what they're doing. They've been there a long, long time and say we are completely paralyzed. So even though some fishing will continue, a lot of it will be shut down for the rest, at least the rest of the summer.
I think with the tourism aspect of it, even in the sports fishermen that would typically go there, they typically don't just fish. You know, they take advantage of some of the other things that are there in that region as well, the beaches or whatever. And so, you know, since the many of the beaches have been closed and that aspect of tourism is shut down, I think that it's the economic part of this is going to be huge. Now, I understand that that there is some sort of a cap that Congress passed some time ago of $75 million on the damages that can be assessed to those that are found to be responsible for this, whether it's BP itself or whether it is the maker of the blowout valve that failed, or who ends up being responsible for this. Have you heard that as well about the $75 million cap on damages?
Yes, that cap is out there, and some people are talking about trying to raise that cap. I mean, we are well beyond $75 million as far as cleanup. I mean, way beyond $75 million as far as cleanup goes. Now, BP is saying that they're not going to hold themselves to that cap. They're saying that they will go certainly beyond the $75 million cap and that they'll take care of whatever it costs. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we're going to have to see if that's the case or not. There's going to be a lot of debate about exactly what BP is responsible for, and they may not want to take responsibility for every single thing that the state of Louisiana or the state of Mississippi wants them to do. And so just how far they'll go, we don't know, but they are saying they're going to go beyond the $75 million.
Yeah, but even if they make that sort of statement, you know, as a goodwill gesture or for PR purposes, these types of things, they can't legally be held, I would imagine, to go beyond. If there was a $75 million cap on damages, they could always limit it to that. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, that is correct. That is right.
What about the aspect, and this is something that I really haven't heard many people talk about. I know that, you know, people want to demonize BP. I completely understand that, why people are doing that. But are we missing something here in the aspect that BP employs thousands of people from this region? I think that I heard estimates of 25,000 people had been are involved in the cleanup and various aspects of this effort to deal with this crisis. Now, I don't know if that is the actual number of employees that BP has in the region, but I would tend to think that it's within the realm of thousands of employees that they have. So if the fishing and the tourism is gone, but it's also tied to the economic damages of a major employer in the area, wouldn't this only exacerbate the problem even more?
Well, sure. There's lots of rigs out there in the Gulf Coast. This is not the only one, and it's not the only one that BP has out there. And so yes, I mean, the economic damage extends to their employees as well. And they are trying to hire some of these fishermen who are out of work. You know, they're giving them contracts to ferry people back and forth from the disaster site, to lay out boom, to do some of these things. And my understanding is that they are paying them a good wage to do that. I think that the fishermen's concern is that, you know, how long is that kind of work going to last, and how much of that work will there be to go around? I mean, these fishermen can only go so far. They're not oil experts. They can't go cleaning it up themselves, and so there's going to be probably a limited amount that they can do. But BP, I think, is really trying to employ these guys to do this. They're offering a hazmat training course, a 40-hour hazmat training course, which is a very expensive course to take normally. They're offering that for free for anyone who wants to take it. And, you know, conceivably, these folks could use that hazmat training in other jobs later. So I do think that for all of the, you know, dastardly mistakes that BP has apparently made in this, they are trying to do what they can to help people on the Gulf Coast.
Did you run into people that, or maybe did you get a sense of the sentiment towards, between the fishermen and those that make their livelihood off of the tourism and fishing industry and those types of things there in the Gulf, and the sentiment between them and the people that they know who work for the oil companies, since they both are coexisting there? Is there animosity towards each other there, or is there, I imagine the people that work for those oil companies would be a bit defensive about, you know, some of the statements that are made and some of the demonizing that takes place. They may not feel that it's completely fair and, you know, really accurately describes what has taken place or who BP is or what they're doing, these types of things. Did you see any of that interaction between those two groups?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit mixed. You know, I was in on a meeting on a local level in a small town called Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, where there were representatives from the town and from the county, but also BP officials. And the BP officials were being very candid. They were, you know, they seemed to be trying to tell them everything that they knew. The BP officials in that local level meeting were not defensive at all. They were, you know, they seemed to be really trying to work with the folks on the local level, and the folks on the local level seemed to appreciate that and reciprocate that and be trying and try to work with BP. So there was, you know, a good relationship that appeared going on there. Now, when you talk to both groups, especially fishermen offline, you know, they certainly do express some anger at BP. I mean, they're upset that this happened, of course. They're upset that this oil is spewing into the Gulf Coast. But as you were mentioning before, they also recognize that their livelihood, a lot of their livelihood, is tied directly to a lot of this offshore drilling. I mean, you know, the Gulf Coast is a prosperous place in part because of offshore drilling. And so they recognize that. They recognize their boats run off of fuel and that they need oil too. And so, you know, the fishermen that I talked to, as upset as they were with BP, were not calling for a ban on offshore drilling. They were saying, we know this needs to happen. We know this needs to go on for our region and for our own business. So it was. There's a lot of, I think, mixed emotion going on, and mostly, above all, just uncertainty and fear about what's coming down the road.
One of the aspects, too, that I've heard mentioned just as a peripheral thought to this issue, and maybe you, I just wanted to get your feedback to see if you've heard anybody express this when you were there, but is there any anger expressed towards the environmentalist movement? Some people may find that an odd question at this time, but the environmentalist movement, you know, was responsible for, as kind of an unintended consequence, but of pushing these rigs so far out into this deep water that the oil actually can be gathered much closer in the shore, but because of you know, the heavy environmentalist lobbying, you know, they required that these rigs go further and further and further out, so that now they're, you know, just to reach the floor of the ocean where they're at, we're talking a mile of pipe, and of course it certainly has added to the difficulty of now dealing with this problem, because everybody's at the mercy of the oil companies, who are the only ones that have the technology to be able to go that deep in order to try to cap this. Has there been any sort of anger expressed that you saw, or any sort of discussions that you heard along that line?
You know, I didn't really hear much about that, to tell you the truth. Folks weren't really, I don't think they were thinking along those lines yet, and perhaps they will be as they start to consider ways to prevent things like this in the future. So I didn't really hear that sentiment, but I think you're definitely right about the fact that this is an unprecedented disaster, partly because of the factors that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an extraordinarily deep well. You know, I think it was, I was reading a piece in Bloomberg that referred to just the pressures and the temperature at those levels as otherworldly, which I thought was a great way to describe it. They were saying you really can't even imagine what it's like at that depth.
Yeah.
And so the further you go out and the deeper you go, the more that's going to be, and the worse the damage is going to be when something like this happens. I mean, it can yield great fruit, and it can also cause, obviously, as we're seeing, horrible damage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go ahead and take a quick commercial break. Can you stay with us a little bit longer? Are you okay?
Sure.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
Thank you.
I want to turn the page here just a little bit and look at some of the political aspects of this, and then also, of course, making a beeline here for talking about just how evangelicals in general should be speaking about this. We're taking our time because I don't think that an issue like this deserves just some sort of a quick statement or a quote. We need to understand this is a very complex issue, and we should, talk about and at least have some understanding of some of the issues that are taking place before we start making some statements about it. We'll do that when we come back from the break. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
This is Dr. Susan Stigall of Integrative Health Group. It is impossible for your body to balance hormones until your insulin is first balanced. Insulin resistance often accompanies the most common complaints I hear, which are fatigue and weight gain. Insulin resistance, diabetes, and hypoglycemia can be corrected. All blood sugar problems are a primary focus of my practice, and our individualized approach has been quite successful. To learn more about a drug-free way to be restored to health, join me for Healthy Alternatives each Tuesday at 12:30.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Stevie B's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Stevie B's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza and they'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Stevie B's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Stevie B's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
If you're a follower of Christ who wants to study God's Word, Crossway Publishers offers a great resource. The ESV Study Bible was created to help people understand the Bible in a deeper way. It's the most comprehensive study Bible ever published, containing over 20,000 notes, 200 full-color maps and illustrations, and over 50 articles. It's also available online. The online study Bible offers some unique features, like the ability to manage your own notes and quick links to references. Check out the award-winning ESV Study Bible at esvstudybible.org.
You've seen the paintings. The Thanksgiving turkey being served at Grandma's. The weathered farmer sending his baby-faced son off to college.
Now be sure and write.
The wise police officer sitting at the soda bar, talking a young boy out of running away from home.
Where are you going, son?
Norman Rockwell didn't create the best in us. He just inspired the best. Inspiration. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back into the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. We're talking today about the tremendous ecological disaster that's taking place in the Gulf related to the environment. And so the environmental disaster that's taking place there as a result of the Gulf oil spill, the rig that was destroyed, that exploded. 11 people lost their life. We shouldn't overlook that in the explosion as well. And ever since that day, well over a month now, I think we're on day like 44 or somewhere along that line, the oil's been spewing out into the Gulf. And of course, this has created huge, huge problems that our country is trying to deal with at this point. Now, we've talked about a couple of these aspects of this disaster from a number of different ways and different vantage points or perspectives. One was environmentally what is taking place. Wanted to just talk about that a little bit. And also we've mentioned some of the economic aspects of this as well and what that those economics will do not only to the states down at the coast, you know, with frontage on the coast and beachfront, but even broader than that. I just heard this morning that 10 miles off of Florida's coast now, they have spotted rusty appearing water, you know, that they feel is, I think it was just confirmed here just recently too, that oil in the water now 10 miles off the coast of Florida. And so there are currents that run along that the Gulf Coast, come right up around the panhandle of Florida and come right up the eastern coast. And so this could come, they're talking about if it follows that path, we could be seeing it here in North Carolina. We're in South Carolina, but even as far as North Carolina, we could be seeing this oil at the coast. I mean, this is just from an environmental and economic standpoint, it is certainly a disaster. Now, we want to switch gears here in just a minute and talk about the political side of this. Before we do that, let me just give you a brief program note about the program tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about burning down the shack. If you've heard about the very popular, in fact, a Christian bestseller, the book The Shack that was written. Well, this is a book against the shack, you know, critiquing what is in the shack. It's written by James B. DeYoung, and he's going to be with me on the program here tomorrow talking about burning down the shack, how the Christian bestseller is deceiving millions. And so we'll be talking about some of the theological errors that are in the book The Shack and just how damaging those errors are and what it says about the Christian community embracing this book so strongly. And so that'll be our discussion on the program tomorrow. Let me tell you, you can participate in the program today, as always. Let me give you the number to be able to do that. It's 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-9535. That's 1-888-660-9535. I also have email up and running, and my email is kevin@knowingthetruth.org. We're speaking with Jamie Dean. Jamie is the news editor for World Magazine. And also, let me tell you that you can get 74% off the cover price by going to my website, knowingthetruth.org, clicking on the link that's there. It'll take you to a page on World Magazine's website, and you can take advantage of this 75% off the cover price of World Magazine, and then you'll be able to read all these great articles that they come out with on a biweekly basis. Jamie, before we go back to our discussion, we've got a caller, Ron, on line two. Ron, welcome into the program today.
Hey, Jamie, this is Ron from the Boardwalk Chapel.
Hey, Ron, how are you?
Hey, Ron, this is my take on this political aspect of this, and I'll use an illustration. If my house is next to a big company that's caught on fire and I have a means by which I can put an end to it, I just don't sit there and let the fire come over and engulf my house thinking that the company's going to pay for it. That well was in federal waters. All the waters around it was the responsibility of this administration. It wasn't like the president couldn't just get stuff out there to start to subdue that oil from spreading further by having to get permission, such as what the last president would have had to got when Katrina came through, which he didn't get from the mayors and the governors. So it seems to be to me there's all this push for whether or not there was some kind of criminal problem here. It just seems so strange that with all the stuff that this administration has pulled and everything else and all the things that have preceded even before this administration came into existence, that the blame shifting is going. And it looks like there should be some kind of investigation into what this administration should have done, because any oil coming out of any well out of the Gulf is necessarily a danger and a risk to the businesses and the people along the coastline. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of anything like that?
Well, thank you, Ron, for your comments. I'll let you take the comments offline. And Jamie, could you hear Ron okay?
I could, yeah. And I think he makes a very important point in pointing out that a lot of these waters are federal waters. I think we mentioned that before. And so, yes, I mean, I think the federal government does have an enormous amount of responsibility in waters that are especially specifically federal waters. And we also know the federal government has a great deal of resources at their disposal. And so a lot of people are saying, why hasn't the federal government been more involved in these things? And it's interesting because, you know, the Republican governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, who is quite a conservative, is also sounding this similar thing. You know, he is for limited government. He's for smaller government and all those things. But, you know, he says at the same time, this is a federal problem, and the federal government should be involved. And he's been very, very critical of the government's response, especially in how they've coordinated with BP. You know, there has been so much kind of finger pointing and blame shifting that it doesn't appear that these entities are working together as well as perhaps they could be if they were all on the same page. I think everyone's very defensive at this point. And so Jindal and others have criticized the coordination aspect of this cleanup, saying it could go better. In fact, Jindal has been just taking matters into his own hands in some cases and organizing his own shore patrols and flyovers and all those sorts of things, saying we've got to step in where other people aren't. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that this is a good point that, you know, pardon the pun, it should be all hands on deck and not just, you know, one group's responsibility.
Mm. A good point. One of the aspects of this that we see take place, of course, is the handling of it by the federal government and specifically President Barack Obama. Does it seem to you that, the president's PR machine, which has been legendary throughout his campaign and even the first couple of the first year or so in the White House, that they've seemed to kind of seized up underneath this this oil crisis, that they appear to be late to show any sort of concern? When they finally did send the president down there, it was fairly ridiculous to have him on the beach. They're picking up those little oil balls, or you know, that they were talking about coming onto the beach. He only spent 3 hours in Louisiana, I was told, and then they compared that with that he spent 5 hours on the golf course. Now his response has been, since coming down there and viewing it for himself, his response has been to have Eric Holder start a lawsuit investigation with, which obviously we know, you know, in paying for this, it's going to be important somewhere along the line. But doing it now makes it seem like the timing is all wrong to be adding, you know, taking away resources, doing this type of thing. Do you agree that the PR machine was just something has gone tremendously haywire with how they handled this particular situation?
I do agree with that. And I think it's kind of surprising on the heels of this massive passage of health care legislation. I mean, an enormous federal, some people would say, intrusion into the health care industry. I mean, untold massive amounts of resources that are going to be folded into health care now. And so when something like this happens that's very tangible, very real, very much, you know, floating in the water right off our shores, the response is, as you were mentioning, has just not been as zealous, for sure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess you could analyze why that is. I mean, I think that there was this quick reaction to blame BP and say this is BP's fault and BP has got to clean it up. And that may have been partly a concern that America Americans were going to say, well, we don't want to pay for one more thing. You know, after the health care legislation, there was such backlash from Americans who were concerned about how much money the federal government was going to be putting into that. Perhaps the Obama administration got a little bit worried about being on the hook for this, but I think they misread the situation when something like this could cause so much more of a disastrous effect and cost so much more money in the long run. I do think that perhaps they got it a little bit backwards in how they responded to it.
And we should note that the assessment of the lackluster response from the administration is not primarily a conservative assessment. The president is getting that earful from both Democrats and Republicans, conservative and liberals. James Carville was on TV, certainly no conservative by any stretch of the imagination, just blasting the president and saying, ending his diatribe on the news program by saying, "We're dying down here. Where are you?" And then followed up after that, we had Maureen Dowd, who wrote a piece where she was, questioning, you know, what in the world is going on with this administration. His response, talk much about the president's eloquency and his ability to sum up these issues and these types of things. His response was more of a Captain Obvious response, where he comes out and says, you know, just plug the hole. Well, I think people have thought about that. And, then he mixed in that corny story about his daughter knocking on the bathroom door while he's shaving and saying, "Daddy, did you plug the hole yet?" I mean, this is just, it really, Carville was saying, if he would have responded properly from an administration that says, don't waste a good crisis. If he would have responded properly, they were saying that his numbers would have gone to the positive of 6 or 7 points. But actually, most people, I think, are seeing that he's not handling this well. He appears distracted. He's meeting with the Duke basketball team. He met with former President Bill Clinton for lunch. He went on vacation during the middle of this. I mean, all of that is just unconscionable when you think of the response, like you were comparing with Bobby Jindal, the governor there of Louisiana.
Yeah, you know, and another, just to mention another editorial, you know, Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal recently said, you know, it would be hard to imagine Obama surviving this politically. Of course, you know, things have shelf lives and people move on from things sometimes and have short memories, but she's saying, you know, this is a catastrophe for him politically as well, because of all the things that we're talking about. And again, it's surprising considering what the president saw with, you know, George Bush's response to Katrina and all of the flack that he took for that, and this perception that the federal government was not on top of things during Katrina. I mean, that was the whole thing during Katrina, that people were saying the federal government was not doing enough. And so why the president didn't see that when a disaster in the very same place came along, I mean, I don't really have an answer for that. It's sort of mystifying, I think, in some ways. But I think it may end up being one of the biggest political miscalculations, even maybe bigger than the health care deal for him.
Mm. You know, they were comparing, and there have been a lot of people saying that this is Obama's Katrina, and some people have gone beyond that to say that this will be worse than Bush's Katrina, because it'll be longer lasting. The cleanup will be much more difficult. The economic portion of it will be across many more states and these types of things. But they said that the reason why that Katrina disaster played into bringing down Bush so strongly was that it was just another piece that the ineptness that had been characterized, that they had made stick with the Bush administration, that this fed into that. And I was wondering, do you see any sort of this fitting into a broader theme with this administration? For instance, one of the themes that was attached to this president early on was his lack of executive experience, that he was, you know, an agitator, a community organizer, these types of things. And people made, some strong points about, you know, he really lacks any sort of executive experience like a governor would have. And so now we're seeing Bobby Jindal, the governor, exhibiting executive experience and taking charge, and we're seeing a lackluster report or response from the president. One other point to that point is another thing that was said of the administration was that they were distracted in their agenda, that they had, for instance, they've been dealing with don't ask, don't tell. I mean, it pales in comparison, right, compared to this type of a disaster. They were spending so much of their time, as you were just saying, about ramming the health care program through, closing Guantanamo, moving the trials to New York City, meddling in Senate races, the whole SESTAC issue that's going on. Do you think that this might then, that there have been kind of a coalition of problems that have come up over the last month or month and a half or so with this presidency, that this may actually then feed into that and have a much broader sense of ringing true with this president?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that a lot of this whole issue comes down to problem solving. I mean, any manager, obviously the president is in some senses the manager of the United States. I mean, a manager of his business, of a small business, comes in and looks at the most immediate problems. He looks at the things that are going to shut his business down and deals with those first, right? I mean, that's what you mm-hmm. do as a good manager. No matter what your political stance is, really, if you look at the president, if you look at how he's approaching this issue, it seems to be down the list somewhat, and I think that is troubling. And I think that's going to trouble, as it already is, people on both sides of the aisle. As you're mentioning, this is not just Republicans or conservatives that are blowing this trumpet. I mean, there are a lot of hardcore Democrats, hardcore liberals who are very upset with the president as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be damaging.
I think that his solutions thus far have been, reactive, like shutting down any more building of any sort of oil rig. Well, as you mentioned, there are already, 1,000 of these out there? I mean, there's already plenty there that stopping the building or the permits from any new ones is not really the issue. The issue really is making sure that if something does happen, we can deal with it, maybe requiring the testing of all of the blowout valves, making sure that those things are tested on a more regular basis. But this knee-jerk reaction to, let's start a lawsuit, let's stop all oil rigs in the Gulf or anything like this just seems to be, again, more politically motivated rather than, really going to help the situation at all. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree. And I think that, as you're mentioning, there's lots of rigs out there that have operated safely for a long time. I don't think that the problem is offshore drilling in and of itself. And that seems to be kind of the reach at the moment. I mean, the president's not saying that he's going to stop all offshore drilling, but to some degree he's got it in his sights. And I think that the rare instances of these accidents prove that this can be done safely. Now, obviously, here's a case where it went terribly, terribly wrong, and I think what this has shown is that we have to be ready for these rare cases, and obviously we weren't. Whoever we are, we were not ready for this. BP wasn't ready for it. The federal government wasn't ready for it. So it's exposed a problem, and one would think that you would move in on that problem, that you would focus on that issue, and that's just not being done at this point.
Mm-hmm. From a biblical perspective of just, we've laid out all the facts and looked at a number of different perspectives of this, you know, and the way that it's impacting a number of different areas. From a perspective, though, of looking at it as believers, there was an interesting story in of all places, the New York Times, this recently, where they spoke about, the article was entitled, Our Fix-It Faith and the Oil Spill. And it, the article, the gist of it was that we have basically put an awful lot of faith in technology itself. And in our day and age, you know, we just feel that, you know, we're really dependent upon technology to the point of that if anything goes wrong in our life, we feel that, you know, if we just have the right technology there, we can just fix this thing and undo the negative consequences. And I think that that has really exposed something here with us, that where is our real trust? Where is our real dependence? Certainly, we've seen that technology can let us down and that we really need to be dependent upon God himself and, you know, just looking to him and resting upon him to protect us and take care of us and not throw so much weight into the arena of technology. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it has certainly unearthed a deep level of fear in a lot of people. You know, one person I talked to on the Gulf Coast described this as kind of the monster under the bed. Mm-hmm. You know, she said, if this was a hurricane coming, we'd know what to do. You know, we could go get our supplies and we'd board up our windows. But she was saying, you know, with this, we don't know what to do. We don't know how to answer this problem. We can't fix this problem overnight. And so I do think that that has, for a lot of people, unearthed this uneasiness with realizing that we are not in control of our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And people are really, I think, grappling with that. And one of the people that I talked with while I was in the Gulf Coast and who I got to know a little bit during Hurricane Katrina was a pastor named Jean LaRue, who actually planted a church in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, after Katrina, basically in response to Katrina, to help rebuild that area. And so he's kind of been sort of, in some ways, the pastor of this town to some degree, just helping these residents and helping the people in his congregation go through the trauma of Katrina and now go through this trauma, you know, and he's just, you know, being very honest with his people and saying, look, we don't know what's coming down the road. We don't know what's going to happen, but we do trust that God is sovereign and that God has a plan for us. He's going to take care of us. You know, he says, I don't say that in a trite way, but this is the testing ground where all that we believe about God and his sovereignty and his care for us is played out. And it does have this tendency to separate those who believe that and those who don't.
Mm. Russell Moore, who is writes a blog called More to the Point. He's also, I think, assistant president, or I don't have his title right here in front of me, but at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, of course, with Dr. Al Mohler and many other great people there. He's written a number of books, been with me on the program before, but he wrote a piece this yesterday, I guess it was, Tuesday, June 1st, about the ecological catastrophe and the uneasy evangelical conscience. And he just, in that blog post, he talks about the fact that as evangelicals, we're just a little bit unsure how to respond to these things because politically, as you've mentioned throughout our discussion here this afternoon, you know, that we are for smaller government and we don't put all of our hope in the federal government. We do feel that taxes are too great and that the restrictions by the federal government and all of these things are too great and we want less government. But because of those things, I think that it makes it difficult for us to respond to catastrophes like this in the right way. As believers, obviously, we should be concerned about the environment and that, you know, good stewards of the world that God has placed us in, but also that the tremendous amount of pain and suffering that this is bringing to the lives of people, like your piece points out, that brings to the lives of people in this area. Do you find in your discussions, you know, you mentioned one case in point there with the pastor from that region where you were doing the story from, but do you find that evangelicals are a little conflicted about how to respond to things like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that evangelicals are often rightly suspicious of the environmental lobby, and so when something like this happens, it can seem like, you know, another reason to be suspicious. And you know, but the thing is that this isn't about, you know, pelicans with oil on their wings, even though it is about that to some degree. I mean, we don't want to ruin God's good creation. We should be good stewards of it, but this does affect people as well, and that's a lot of what I try to point out in my story, is that it affects wildlife, but it also affects real people with real lives. And so evangelicals of all people, I hope, will be especially sympathetic to that, to the suffering that's going on in that region, and the fact that it could last a very long time.
Mm. Well, Jamie, this has been a very interesting discussion. Really appreciated the piece that you wrote here, and just taking the lead there in this issue of World Magazine speaking about this. I want to give you an opportunity before we close out the program today. I know you're working on some other pieces as well, but just give you the last word. Is there any aspect of the discussion that we've been in today that maybe we left untalked about that maybe you want to address, or do you want to give us a little sneak peek at what's coming up that you're working on?
Well, I can tell you that the next story that I'm working on is a story about the 30th year of China's one-child policy. Very different than what we're talking about today.
Right.
Completely changing subjects, but this is the 30th year that China has instituted their one-child policy, and of course has allowed untold millions of forced abortions and abandonment of especially baby girls in China. So we're taking a look at that policy 30 years later, what that's done to the country of China, the kind of the demographic chaos that is wreaking in China, but also just the spiritual and psychological and emotional damage that's caused to so many women and so many girls in China, and really kind of what can be done moving forward. So that's what we've got coming up in World Magazine, so hope people will check that out. And also the people will, just in one last word on the Gulf Coast thing, keep an eye on that. You know, don't shelve that away. We tend to have short memories when it comes to these things, but I think that you're making a great point that this is something that Christians should be concerned about and should stay well informed with. And so I hope that your listeners will do that.
You know, speaking about, you mentioned about China's policy there, which is certainly something that we should be, you know, aware of and interested in and fighting against and doing whatever we can do to put a policy like that to cause it to stop. But you also wrote in this issue, right, about other places around the world where Christians are just going through a tremendous amount of difficulty in what's taking place. Was your article about seeing red, that's right, the strained friendship between, was it Morocco?
Yes, that was, we've been covering the situation in Morocco where Christians have been being basically deported out of Morocco all of a sudden. We're really kind of unsure what's going on there, but Christians involved in just regular life in Morocco being kind of booted out all of a sudden.
Hmm. And as you mentioned, all of these things are certainly should be of interest to any Christians to read about. Sometimes a story like the Gulf one, you know, comes to the front, bubbles up to the front, no pun intended, to the top of our mind when we're thinking about things. But all of these issues are things that should be of interest to any believer. And so that's why I make mention of World Magazine so often about keeping abreast of these different situations. Well, Jamie, thank you very much for writing about this issue that we discussed today and about these other issues facing Christians around the world. Thank you for your work there at World Magazine. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. That was Jamie Dean. Jamie is the news editor for World Magazine. And as I was talking about, just a number of interesting stories, again, in this issue of World Magazine. You need to get one for yourself. I've got it open here right in front of me. There's a story by Emily Bells about the Supreme Court nominee, Elena Kagan. And so you can go out there and read her thoughts about that Supreme Court nominee. So many different issues that we face in this world today. That's why we call it Worldview Wednesday, because we're looking at things that are taking place in our world and trying to bring a Christian perspective to bear on what we see, so that when people ask us about these issues, we can be informed about them, have thought through the issues, had some help here from the writers, reporters, and editors there at World Magazine, in order to formulate our thoughts to be able to talk about these things in an intelligent manner. And so let me just encourage you once again, if you go out to my website at knowingthetruth.org, that's www.knowingthetruth.org, you'll see there a link in the right-hand column that says 74% off the cover price. Click on that. It'll take you right to World Magazine. And you can start receiving this in your mailbox on a bi-weekly basis for a very, very reasonable price that you'll see when you go to that link. I want to thank you again for listening to another edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. Tomorrow we'll be talking about an important theological issue. We'll be talking about a book called The Burning Down of the Shack, or Burning Down the Shack, How a Christian Bestseller is Deceiving Millions. I witnessed this myself at many of the book conventions. The Shack was prominently displayed. How should we think about that book? We'll talk about that tomorrow on tomorrow's broadcast. Remember, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily